Lee, she hugged me because we both had real short hair. She said we're twins. Had nothing to do with the fact that we're both alcoholics. And a privilege through the week. We had little spurts together and then enjoyed dinner as a group. And what I want to share with you, I was thinking about what I wanted to say, and I've heard the phrase in the rooms that you might be the only big book someone would ever see. Carol might be the promises someone would only see. I've heard her in her sharing and watched her in her actions know a new freedom and a new happiness. There is a zest for life no matter what she's doing. If she's talking to me about something or eating pork roast or going to a Civil War event. Just sharing her life. She's been given a very rich and abundant life. Precious friends drove to come and support her. Carol is an example of the promises in recovery. I don't know her story. I don't know her recovery date. I give you Carol.
Good evening, or morning, or afternoon, whatever it is. I'm extremely nervous. My name is Carol Campbell, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Carol.
Whoa, what an introduction. That touched my heart so much. There's so many things that I want to do first, and the very first thing is to thank the committee so much. Thank this Altoona Roundup for being here for us and keep coming back to it. We've been here several times, and this is the first time I was asked to speak. I am. Someone asked me last night. They said, "Are you a circuit speaker?" And I said, "Oh Lord, no! Lord, no! I don't want to ever be a circuit speaker. Thank you, but no. This is my least favorite thing to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I do want to thank the committee so much for inviting me. Jerry and Jeanette, we met them several years ago at the Huntsville Roundup that we hold every February in Huntsville, Alabama. And they are joy. The very reason I met Jeanette, I fell in love with her. Her name is Jeanette. My middle name is Jeanette. I very rarely even remember my middle name. I never use it. And when I heard her name, I thought, oh, my God, I'm so glad to meet somebody that's got the name Jeanette. It's such a different name. But we've been very good friends since then. I also want to congratulate y'all on the 30th anniversary. That is such an important time. I don't know about you guys, but I work on two different roundups. And every milestone that we have is opens our hearts even more to realize that the work and the efforts that we put into it are worthwhile when we see people show up and grasp a little bit more of this wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous. One other thing is I certainly want to thank Nick for his wonderful talk. Oh, if you have not got his tape, please get his tape. It is so heartwarming. Also, Stephanie. Stephanie told a lot of things about myself because, as I'll say later in my talk, I came from an alcoholic home. A lot of us do. Most of us do. In one way or the other, a family member or whatever it may be. And also for Tim last night for speaking. I laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed because I could relate so much to everything that you had to say. I will tell you, I'm not a funny speaker. Oh, gosh, I wish I could. Tim's so good at it, and Nick did such a wonderful job. I probably cry more than I do anything else. I am so emotional as far as the Alcoholics Anonymous program is concerned. My sobriety date is December the 13th of 1987. It is only because of the grace of a loving God that y'all have shown me how to find in this program, showed me how to pray to on a daily basis in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, our basic texts, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsorship, and a group that I am here today. And I am very, very grateful to everything that's come to me. It has been unreal. This ride is just going further and further and further. I'd like to set the stage to tell you a little bit about myself. And the reason I do this is because it explains everything that happened, okay? I grew up in a military home. My father was in the military and stayed in the military for 20 years. My father was not my real father. My father was my stepfather. It was when I was 46 years of age, I was fortunate enough to find the grave of my real father and make some peace through this program of Alcoholics Anonymous with my real father. I thought he had left me because he didn't love me. My stepfather was overbearing and very, very military. It was the old, you will suit up and show up whenever you're told to suit up and show up, and you will do what you are told type thing. My stepbrother and I, where's 2 years difference in us, started on this little journey with this new marriage when I was 6 years old and he was four. And I have never forgotten the trip from moving. We live with my grandmother because my mother was a divorced woman back then. Oh, my God. So she was kind of shunned by a lot of things. But anyway, but I have a big family. We had lots of aunts and uncles, and I had lots of cousins. And I live with Mama and Papa, and my big Mama and big Papa live right next door to me. I mean, I was loved and spoiled rotten, oldest grandchild. I was living in Hog Cabin, and we were in the back seat of this car, and I can remember looking out through the windshield and seeing the house in the background and thinking, what's going on in my life here? What's going on in my life? And I never knew what kind of trip this was going to be. We moved to Memphis, Tennessee. Actually, we moved to Millington, and that was the first station. From there, we went to Norfolk, Virginia. From Norfolk, Virginia, we went to La Jolla, California, and San Diego, California, and Chula Vista, California. And then we spent 2 years overseas on Guam, almost 3 years. We came back to California for another stay, and our last and final place before he retired was in 1962 when we moved to Huntsville, wherever that was at, Alabama. Because, you see, look, I had been a California girl for quite a few years now. You had to realize that I was different. So I thought, tough, tough times. A couple of things that occurred to me over those years was one of the things as I learned to do is I learned that every time we moved, I could be a different person. You know, I could take these fears and this anger and this resentments against everything that was going on in my life, and I could go to a new place and I could start over again. You know, I could be a different person everywhere I went. My only problem was, is everywhere I went, I took me with me. You know, I was taking me with me before I even got drunk. Okay? I took me with me, and I still had those fears, those angers, and those resentments inside of me. Because life wasn't what I thought it ought to be. It was harsh. I thought life was supposed to be peaches and cream and roses. I don't know what I thought. I mean, I knew what it was like growing up with those aunts and uncles and everybody loving on me all the time and spoiling me rotten and being, you know, it was just so different whenever into this new thing that we were into. But it was pretty tough for a long time there. When we moved to Huntsville, Alabama, I was a junior in high school. That was tough. I had a real rough time growing up. I really did. Even though I could be whomever I, you know, change my personalities to suit the situation, and I'm real good at it even today. But it is terrible whenever you try so hard to be a part of. I can remember when I was in the fifth grade, very, very, very distinctly. I wanted so bad to belong to one of those groups. The groups. You know, I learned to play jacks, and I was learning. Oh, I was great at it, man. You know, great. I practiced all the time so I could beat the rest of the girls, and I could be a part of that little club that sit and play jacks at lunchtime. A lot of people may not know what jacks are anymore, but we used to play jacks during lunch. There also was some young ladies that liked to do skits, and they would sing, and I would try to sing, and I wanted to be a part of it. I couldn't be a part of it because I couldn't sing. So many things I couldn't do. But those things started playing a factor in my life because I realized that, you know, I wasn't like the rest of the kids. I was such a loner. We spent most of our time, my brother and I, we spent most of our time at home doing the chores and taking care of my half-sister, who is 9 years younger than we are, and cleaning up the messes that they made whenever they got drunk and puked all over the place, and taking care of the ironing, taking care of the bathrooms, keeping them clean, changing the sheets and the towels and the beds, and sweeping the floors and hanging the laundry out on the line. Heck, I've been hanging laundry out on the line since before I could even reach the line. But you know what? They got these funny little sticks that you can stick up underneath them. You can push them up, and you can bring them back down, and you put your thing on there, and you push them up real quick. I learned how to do all that. But those are just things that were occurring. It was necessary for me to learn to do those things. I didn't like it. I hated it. I was pissed off at the world. And I stayed that way for a long, long time. Graduated from 1964, barely, but I did graduate. Oh, yeah, one of the things that happens to you when you travel a lot like that is you go into one school and they're on chapter 13, you go to the next school and they're on chapter 30, and you don't know what in the world happened in between. So you miss out on a lot. If you're not super intelligent or really want to study a lot, which I didn't, then you're going to miss out on a lot. Met a young man one night, 1965, that was driving a yellow with black upholstery Chevrolet Impala. I was in love. It was a nice car. It was a really nice car. I liked that car. He'd gun it every now and then, you know, that feeling that you had. Phew, it was awesome. But we ended up doing the he and she and thing, you know, and I ended up getting pregnant. 2 weeks before we were marrying for the right reasons, I found out he had two kids and had been married before. So you see, I didn't know what I was doing back there. And I wish that was the end of it, but that isn't the end of it. The two boys came to live with us, and I became the stepmother. I had three children by the time I was 20 years of age. Now, one of the things, every other weekend they went to their mothers. Every other weekend, regardless of what was going on, they went to their mothers. I was trying to learn to be a wife, a mother. I had no idea how to be either one. I had to use what I had learned when I was growing up. And the tools were pretty shoddy. Okay, the tools were not really good tools. Even knowing how to love him. I don't think I ever really knew how to love him. I knew what I was supposed to do. I was supposed to take care of him, you know, keep his clothes ironed, keep the house clean, watch the kids. And that's all I knew. You know, that's all I knew. We struggled along for quite a few years. We made it 9 years. And one of the things that I do have to let you know about is I do have to let you know that during those 9 years, I was mentally and physically abusive to those boys. Still hurts. They've forgiven me. And they still call me mom. But it was tough. You know, all I had to take with me was what I learned. And I didn't have a lot of good skills. And I was very, 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 very bad to those children. And he divorced me, like I say, after 9 years because of my cruelty to the children. Now, that wasn't the reason it says on the divorce, and whatever those common thing is. Irreconcilable differences or whatever it is, but I was still divorced. And I got my 9-year-old daughter, and her and I tried to start a life. I was bitter. God, I was bitter. I was so angry. He had a girlfriend. Can you imagine? A girlfriend. Went over to her house one night when he was there and jerked his wig off his hair and threw it off his head and threw it in the ground. They called the cops on me, broke a glass out of her window. I don't know why they were so upset with me. You know, I was just standing up for my rights. That's the way I handled that divorce. Now I had to go to work. Now I hadn't worked in over almost 10 years. I hadn't worked. Went to work for a wholesale warehouse and because of the lady that I knew, and then I had worked there for a while, and then after we got this divorce, I went to a bank, and became a teller, worked there a couple of months, and because he kept bringing her with him when he picked up my daughter, I decided I was going to move. I was just going to take her and go somewhere else, and so I did. I went home to Mama and Daddy. I went back into the same thing that I had been living in and saying I would never go back there again. That didn't last but 2 or 3 weeks, and I was packing up and coming back up here to Huntsville, Alabama. Got me my job back, was able to start working, and we tried to start living some kind of life. I don't know. I guess we did okay. I had a settlement from the house, and so it was no money problems at that time. We did pretty good. Got her in school, and she was doing all right. She's always been an excellent student. She's just wonderful daughter, wonderful daughter. But we were moved into an apartment complex, and it wasn't until shortly after that that I ran into a young lady that asked, met her and kind of liked her a little bit, and she seemed to like me a little bit, and she asked me out one night, and I said, well, okay. Now, one of the things I will tell you is growing up in the alcoholic home, I was scared shitless of alcohol, and I'm sorry to say it that way, but that's the truth. I was petrified of it. I just knew that I just knew what it did to people, and I just didn't want that to happen to me, okay? I'm never going to be like my mama. I'm never going to have to drag they're not going to have to drag me out from underneath a bed or throw me into a car and try to get me to go pick up my daughter at a school somewhere when I couldn't even see the road and the blackouts and the puke all over. I'm never going to be that way. I'm not going to be that way. There is no way I'm going to be that way. But we went to this little pub, and I didn't know even about what to order. She ordered rum and coke, and I think it was 3-for-1 that night. And I said, okay, I'll have the same thing. For some odd reason, I decided I was going to try it. So I tried that rum and coke, and oh, my gracious me alive. Oh, I loved it. I loved that rum and coke, and I had my second one. Man, I loved that rum and coke, and I drank another one, third one. Then I ordered another round. Now, what I briefly noticed during this time, she was still sipping on that number one, and I thought, well, she just doesn't know how to do it, But also what I started noticing for myself is all of a sudden I had that hole in my stomach filled up. I was feeling happy. I was not scared. I was enjoying myself. I was flirting like crazy. The guys thought I looked gorgeous. They were drunk too, but and the guys, oh God, they were so handsome, you know. That's what started me on this road. Now I wished I could tell you that from there to December the 13th of 1987 that it was a real easy ride, and it went, you know, I just got drunk every now and then, blacked out a little bit, and that was about it. But that's not the truth. The truth of it, it was, in the beginning, yeah, it was kind of fun, you know. There were some parties and some funs, and I could normally do okay. But being the good person that I am as far as an alcoholic, I picked up the alcoholism and the alcohol and went, ping, and it exploded in me. And I was on a wild ride that I could not recover from, a wild ride that would take me to places I did not want to be, to situations that I would never have thought I would have been in. As a book tells us, incomprehensible demoralization. That's where I ended up. Little regard for this daughter that was still living with me. I didn't care what she was doing, where she was doing it, or who she was doing it with. She just needs to stay out of my way because, my God, I'm going to do what I'm going to do when I'm going to do it. She'd say, Mom, I need to do so-and-so. Well, you can find you a ride. There's plenty of people living out here. They'll give you a ride wherever it is you want to go. Well, Mom, I'm not going to be home tonight. Okay, no problem. I didn't care. I did not care. This daughter that is just a wonderful, wonderful woman today. She suffered from my alcoholism the way I suffered through my parents' alcoholism. So here was this family spreading this disease all the way down the line. I almost forgot. I met another guy. Number two. But he was a DJ. You know, he was at a radio station. He was a DJ. He was different. You know, he was a nice guy, you know. He traveled a lot. Only problem was is when we went to the courthouse to get married, I found out he had been married 5 times before. I knew a lot about these guys, you know? I knew a lot about these guys. Lord, gracious me. Well, that didn't last but 6 months. Threw him out because I realized that not only was he been married 5 times before, but he was also still playing around with anybody and everybody that would stand still long enough for him to get a hold of him. So we only lasted 6 months. And then after that, my alcoholism just really escalated even more. Because I was rid of him, I was rid of, you know, my daughter was occasionally, was getting older and she was taking care of herself all the time, and it just escalated till that's all I did. I'd wake up in the morning, have a drink, I'd go to bed with a drink by my bed. You know, I always had a bottle. May not have had anything else. Told this guy one time that I used to date, I told him, I said, I'm going to have two things in my life I'll always have. That's money for gas and money for booze. And I meant that. I thought that was important. And right back then, it was important. It was very important because, you see, I couldn't survive without that alcohol. It had me. I wanted that alcohol. It did those things for me I couldn't do. I didn't care if I went into blackouts and didn't know where I was at. I didn't care about nothing. I didn't have to care. And that's what I wanted, is not to have to care. Until the pain and the agony and the despair and the total isolation got to me. And it got me. And it wrapped me up in its little womb and it said, you're mine. And I was it. That was it. One night in desperation, I'd ended up living in a trailer. Nothing wrong with trailers except for I thought I was better. Moved into a trailer and ended up, by myself, totally by myself. I was still working for a bank, going in on Tuesdays. You know, we don't work on Mondays. Finally. She got it. But I never can make it on Mondays, and they kept telling me, Carol, you're missing too much work. You're gonna have to start doing so and so and doing so. And a little fear there started coming in. Oh my God, now what? I've done used all the excuses I could possibly think of. The last time that they called me and it told me that I had to be at work on Monday or I was gonna have to do it without pay, I did the usual wonderful lies that we are so good at. But you see, I don't have any money. Well, you've got a so-and-so in your account, because they could see my account. And I said, yeah, but that's all allocated. I got checks out on that. You know, I can't go to the doctor. So it's only $8. I can't go to the doctors. I don't have any money. So one other thing that I will share with you, and it's been mentioned so many times, is that lying bit. You know, when I was a little kid, 6, 7, 8 years old, I learned about a lie and how that lie would help me feel better and help me get past that situation at that time. And from then on, it was Katie bar the door. Because I would, like they said, so it's been so well said this weekend, I'd lie to you when the truth was so easy. The truth was much better. But I'd lie to you. I lied to my parents. I lied to my teachers. I lied to my friends. I'd lie to my daughter. I'd lie to my husbands, you know. I just didn't know any differently at that time. That's all I knew to do was to lie. Because I felt if I lied about it, you know, it's going to be the way I want it to be, and ain't nothing going to be the way I was going to want it to be. Because my life was slowly going into hell. One night in total desperation in this trailer, sitting on a Sunday night like I normally was, I had come out of a blackout. I was had a phone in one hand and a knife in the other hand, and I was screaming bloody murder. But you don't understand. You just don't understand. And there was a lady on the line that happened to be from Charter Retreat Hospital in Decatur, Alabama, talking to me and asking me, can I get over there? Now, I don't know. I'd seen them ads on TV, but I'd never written that number down. I didn't know. I thought I was mentally insane, you know, and I just wanted to be locked up. Somehow or another, I got that phone number. Okay, and I don't know where it came from. I can't tell you today. All I know is I woke up out of the blackout and had him on the phone. And I told him, yeah, I can get over there, no problem. You know, what it was, 2 o'clock in the morning? No problem, yeah, I can get over. You're not going to drive, are you? No, I'll call my son-in-law, my daughter married at that time. So I called him. He came over and picked me up. One of the things that came strictly to mind at that time that I can still remember and I can still see very, very vividly, after I stumbled down the steps outside my trailer and went waddling over to the car and finally got in, turned around and looked, I can see my son-in-law standing there at that door with my bottle of vodka, doing this and looking at me with the most disgusted look I believe I've ever seen in my life. By that time, I wouldn't even go visit my daughter. I wouldn't visit my son-in-law when he went to the hospital to have his appendix taken out. I wouldn't do anything. She called, I'd lie. And all I did was spend all my time laying on my couch in front of my TV set with my bottle sitting next to me. And that was my life. That was my entire life. Went over to Charter Retreat Hospital the beginning of April in beginning of March in 1987. They checked me in, and all of a sudden I felt really safe for a change. I felt safe and protected for a change. They drugged me up and got me detoxed and started trying to put me on some kind of a program. And I was listening to the counselors, and I kept telling them, I said, I just had a bad night that night. I'm not a bad drunk. I just mentally insane, I think. I really do think I am. So they did the classic psych test and told me, no, I wasn't nothing but an alcoholic. And I went, oh, well, I can fix that, you know. So I do what I had to do. People have said it before. I did what I had to do to get out of there. You know, if they wanted a little bit, I'd give them a little bit. But that's all I was going to give them. I was only going to give them a little bit. They weren't going to get it all. They were not going to get all this garbage that was inside of me. Work, at that time, I couldn't care less whether they wanted me back or not. I didn't care whether my bill was paid or not. I didn't care about anything except for I was finally into a place that was safe. Finally, a place that was taking care of me because I couldn't take care of myself. My teeth were rotting out. They were breaking out like crazy. I probably weighed 112 pounds, maybe 115. Circles under my eyes, my hair was falling out, and I thought, you know, when I used to look in the mirror, I thought I was gorgeous, you know, still, you know. All I was seeing when I was looking in that mirror was I was seeing what I remembered from the past. I couldn't see the present. I never took makeup off. Hell, I just added more to it, you know. That's all you do. You just add more to it and keep right on going. But it works, you understand. But one of the things that I was able to do is fully look at myself for a change. One time, I was finally able to see myself in that mirror and see what I had become. Went through the 30-day program and they let me out, and I went to the fellowship group in Huntsville, Alabama, to meet this new sponsor, whatever that is, that they had. I attended a couple of meetings while I was there, but I liked the guys better. Okay. You know, the guys were pretty cool. I had two boyfriends, and, you know, I wanted those guys to meet me after we got out, and we was going to do all sort of kind of things together, you know. One of the guys, it's so awesome, one of the guys that I was in treatment with at that time was named Andy. And Andy's probably, maybe 15, 20 years younger than I am. When he first came into the treatment center, he had down to here, had bottle glasses because he had destroyed his eyes so bad. It was so thick, you know, you could hardly see his eyes. And the neatest thing was several years later, he and I ended up in the same home group. So he and I are real buds. I love him. I love him so much. And he loves me. And it was so awesome to see him show back up. He had to do like what I did. I had to go back out and drink one more time. He had to go back out and drink one more time. His lasted longer than mine did. Mine lasted from my belly button birthday. I had to celebrate. God, I mean, it's, you know, 28th of June, I went out and drank. That was my birthday. From June the 28th until December the 13th, December the 12th, the roller coaster had gone so far downhill then, I couldn't get drunk. It would not work. Would not work. Could not get drunk. In desperation, I picked up the phone and called Alcoholics Anonymous. And two people came over and asked me to come to a meeting and told me that they would be glad to come pick me up if I would like to go. I knew I was still drunk, and I asked them if they would wait till tomorrow night. I laid on the couch and went to sleep finally. But I had been sitting on this couch for hours, sitting there in total I couldn't move. I couldn't not move. I couldn't blink. I couldn't think. There was nothing inside of me. There was such an emptiness of everything that I knew that the only place I could think of, the only place I could think of was that Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I had gone to those meetings, even drunk, and they tolerated me, when I had gone into those meetings, those people would look at me and kind of grin and say, "We're glad you're here. You know, you keep coming back." And I thought, "Yeah, right, you want me back." And the next one would come up and they'd say, "You know, you keep coming back. Yeah, I'm glad you're here." I think, well, maybe that's what they meant. And then there was this sign over the door, and it says, "You are never alone again." And I thought, wow, because I am the most loneliest person in the world. If they just knew. But you know what? They did know. They did know exactly how I felt. But I started this journey. I started reading the big book. I started going to 100,000 meetings a day, which is what it seemed like. The doors open, I was down there. I couldn't trust myself to be anywhere else. Doors open, I was there, man. Still working, still, oh man, I had penalties to pay there. But oh well, you know, I did what I had to do to save my life at that time. And I was willing to do whatever was necessary. And I started this journey that is such an awesome, awesome, awesome experience. Got a sponsor. We started working the steps. And one of the things that was hard for me to learn to do, and that was to learn how to pray and to learn to find a God that was greater than me. My God was a getchy God, you know. He done got me a long time ago, and I didn't know it. But he got me in a good way. He let me run my gamut of what I had to do. Threw me out there, let me do it. And then he gave me the folks to help me find him again. I didn't know that you could pray and not have to pray for specific things, you know. I didn't know. I thought you had to ask for, "I need a big house and a big car and fine clothes." I thought you were supposed to do things like that, because I was brought up a little, like I say, a little differently. And but what I found out is I just needed to ask God to help me on a daily basis to stay sober. And that's all I needed. I didn't need anything else. God, help me. That's it. God, help me stay sober today. And then in the evening, thank you. And I started doing that. I'd ask him in the morning to help me to stay sober. And I'd go to sleep at night with saying, "Thank you, God. Would you please help me stay? Thank you for helping me stay sober today." And that's all I did in the beginning, because that's all I knew. I want to tell you a little bit about my group that I have. My group, it is the Fellowship Group in Huntsville, Alabama. It's been my group since the very get-go. I love my group. We have a lot of new people, and I love to give them a hard time. I don't mean a hard time. I'm constantly teasing with them. You know, I don't let them sit and be mopey. I don't let them sit. I let them see that there's wondrous things out there. You can be happy. You can have a joyful life. You can find peace and harmony with the God of your understanding. You can learn to do those steps. I swear you can do it. My God, if this old drunk here can do it, I know good and well you can do it. And every time I walk into that room, they go, either going, "Uh-oh, here she comes." Or they're going, "Hey!" You know? So that's my job today. It is. It is a wonderful job. You know, you can walk in and I'm just filled with energy and filled with laughter, and I'm always trying to grin at them and let them know that life's good. And because, you know, I don't know about you, but we used to have some guys that used to come in and, "Hello there, yeah, I'm glad to be here." You know, and you go, "Yeah, right. Well, tell your face." But, you know, I can't do that. I can't do that. I do have an enthusiasm for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, because the promises have come true in my life. As Mary so graciously said, it has come true in my life. And I want these people to understand you can do it. You can be grateful. You can thank God every day. And it's so simple. It is so simple, because this dumb little drunk here who grew up not knowing how to do anything could learn to do it. Now, when we came in 1987, and I say we because I want you to know my husband is sitting over here, and his name is Victor Campbell. He has 1 month more than I do in the program of alcoholics, and he didn't let me forget it.
He's got more time.
But we met in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a matter of fact, we met New Year's Eve of 1987. Now, if you remember, I came in December 13th of 1987. I found another one. But I can tell you this much. I found the best one. Okay? My husband loves me unconditionally through the hard times, through the good times, through the, hey, it's just another day. My husband loves me, and I know this. I used to be extremely and insanely jealous person. Do you know I've not felt that emotion at all ever since we have been together? Well, one time. But that was legitimate. She was hugging a little too close to suit me. But isn't that a wonderful feeling? You know, it's a wonderful feeling. But we had really, really good sponsors, okay? Mine was real tough. His was real tough. We went to him and told him what we were doing. We were going to live together. They rolled their eyes at us and told us, you know, the normal things that they tell you. But one of the things that they were very, very strict about is you walk through those doors. I had better not see either one of you talking to each other, sitting next to each other, or making goo-goo eyes at each other. And you know what? We didn't. And you know what? We still don't. Okay? We still don't. We have been in meetings before, and they'll go, "You're married to him?" And I go, "Yeah, he's married to me, too." Because, you know, we learned early that we were to go to Alcoholics Anonymous if we wanted to stay sober and learn to change our entire life. He learned it. I learned it. I don't know what he does, but I go into a meeting for me. I go into a meeting and have a good time. I go into the meeting and read my book. I go in there and share my experience, strength, and hope. I learn to do the steps. Even today, I learn more and more about the steps and the traditions by coming to these meetings. But we do not act married at a meeting. I mean, we just, it's not necessary. That's not what I'm there for. Okay? That's not what I'm there for. I'm there to stay sober. We've had a lot of tragedies in our lives. My husband's lost both his parents. I've lost my stepfather and my mother. I've lost my grandparents. He's lost a brother, a sister. But one of the greatest joys that I think that has happened to the both of us is with my daughter. Victor has a son. I have a son now. Love him to death. He's a great big old teddy bear. Awesome kid. Awesome kid. And my daughter calls him Dad. Now, she had her real dad still around, still visits and all that stuff. But she calls him Dad. She has a problem, she'll call him. She'll call me, she'll call him. Victor's the quiet, non-assuming, laid-back person. I'm the type person. And I go 10,000 miles per hour. But that is cool. That is really cool. That he loves her as much as she loves him. We had I have two grandsons, too. One of them is going to be 10 this month, and I have one that's 3 years old, and it's a holy terror. Man, he is boy, 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 boy. When my first grandson was born, and he had a heart murmur, and we were a little concerned, but they started doing a few tests on him, and the heart murmur was just going to be mild, and everything seemed to be doing pretty good. But the first six months, the year, we started noticing things were not working right. And they had suggested to us that possibility he may be a Williams syndrome child. And we didn't know anything about that. So here we go, on the computer, finding out everything we possibly can. When he was almost 2 years of age, he was diagnosed as being a Williams syndrome child. He has the most gorgeous starburst around both pupils. Beautiful blue eyes. Okay? But he does have some problems. Okay? He is mentally challenged. Now, I'm like all grandmamas, okay? I want him to grow up to be a football player, Harvard, be a lawyer, you know? And God gave me him. Because you see, this is a child that loves unconditionally. Totally unconditionally. The only thing he wants from Nana is a hug and a kiss, and that's all. And a smile. That's all he wants. That's all he wants. He doesn't want anything else. And he came along, and he has graced our lives and taught us how simple life is wonderful life. And that's what he's taught us. We never thought he would ever learn to read. And this last year, he learned to read. He can read. It is awesome. We did not know he would be able to do that, but he has. His little brother is, well, like I said, he's all boy. I love him to death, man. We can't keep up with him, but we try. My stepson, he's building a home or fixing up a home in Auburn. My daughter lives in Birmingham. She's got one of them big executive jobs that has to travel a lot. My son-in-law is my new son-in-law that she married and I had these children by. Is a simple country boy from Arab, Alabama. He stands about that tall and, you know, big old dude. Looks like a woolly booger. I call him Woolly Booger. But you know what? They seem to be making a go of it. Life is wonderful. Life is truly wonderful today. Victor and I were married in 1989. And we're still married one day at a time. We're not married any more than that. He told his sponsor when he got married, he can only be married one day at a time. And that's the way we are married today, is one day at a time. You know, I guess it's time to let you know how much I love you. There's someone in the room today, that may be having a hardship right now. There may be someone in this room who's got a lot of joy that they want to share. I do want you to know, though, that there is also someone in this room who loves each and every one of you, and that person is me. Thank you for being here. Thank you for allowing me to share today.